This is a recorded interview with Mrs. Avita Cup Hobby by Forrest C. Pogue in Houston, August 28, 1963.
When the committee set this bill for hearing, General Marshall asked me if I would testify and represent the War Department and express the War Department's views. That of course I would. I worked closely with D1 and then the Assistant Secretary of War, Mr. McCoy, and General Persons, who was in General Marshall's liaison to the Hill. And testimony had all been prepared, and we had done a dry run, so to speak. And the morning that I was supposed to go up, General Marshall called for me and sat down and said, would go up to testify. Yes, I said. We talked about a number of things. And he asked me if I'd ever testified for a congressional committee, and I told him I had not. He said, you know what you're going to say? I said, yes, you. And I told him about all the preparation of the testimony and the dry run, and I had it folded in my purse, and I handed it to him. And he looked it over, and he put it over his wastebasket. And said, now I'm going to give you a piece of advice. When you go to testify before a congressional committee, you say what you have to say. And I said, well, General, there are many questions they will ask me that I will not know the attitude of the War Department. I am about as unmilitary a person as ever existed. And he said, when you do not know what the attitude is, he said, that's what you have a staff for. That's what members of G1 are going there. And when you do not, you got a question that you don't know how to answer, you refer to your staff. Well, he kept talking, he kept visiting, and the hour kept getting near, and I was very embarrassed for fear that I would be late for the committee, and knowing full well that I could not excuse myself from the office of the chief of staff. But the interview was finally terminated, and I got in the car and found the mall entrance, and the G1 officer who was waiting for me. I told him what had happened. The General Marshal had torn up my testimony and told me to make a statement. And I said, what does he expect me to do? Throw the mantle of a chief of staff around my shoulders when I testify? And he said, well, that's exactly what he means you do, and you better do it. Well, the thing that he knew, General Marshall, later he learned that for years I had been parliamentarian to the Texas legislature. I used to tell with great glee about the long lecture that he had given me about how to appear before a parliamentary body. And he said, that woman never indicated to me by word or sign that she knew anything about this.
But he got by the way.
I'm just trying to recall other will. Of course, after there were many consultations while that bill was in progress in the House and in the Senate. And when it became known that the bill was going to pass, he asked me for the names of people that I would recommend to head the Corps. And I gave him about six or seven names I would recommend. And I didn't hear anything more for about 2 weeks, and he sent for me, and he had that list, and he said, thank you for this list, but we want you to head the Corps. And I said, well, General, I have no military experience, none. He pointed out that no other woman did, too, so this was a... Well, anyway, to make a long story short, I told him I would talk to my husband about it, and I did. And my husband had been the one who thought I should go as a consultant, because he felt that war was inevitable and that no one should refuse to do anything. And he said this again, that no one must refuse to do anything like that. So I did agree to do it. I think one of the great qualities of General Marshall was the understanding he had of other people and of other people's problems. And my husband came up from the swearing-in ceremony. When it was over, General Marshall stepped over to where my husband was sitting and said, "Governor Holly, could you come into my office when that meeting was over?" Will went on in, and General Marshall said, I know that any man must have great trepidation about his wife undertaking such an assignment. But I wanted you to tell him, I want to tell you here, that the Secretary of War and I mean to give her every support and aid in doing what we know would be a very difficult job. And Will said, "Well, General Marshall, I had intended to seek an appointment with you to discuss this very thing." He said, "I know that it would be very difficult to form a corps and make it acceptable not only to the Army but to the population who are not accustomed to the idea." General Marshall had an uncanny intelligence. He always seemed to know when people had problems and needed help. And this was, to be sure, someone may have told him, but often the squawk box would go down. And he'd say, "Well, are you free for lunch today? Come home and lunch with Catherine and me." And we'd have lunch and he'd say, "Well, any problems?" But this always happened at a time when I had problems. So I've always considered that either his intuition or his intelligence was extremely good.
But this way, say, he asked for it, and you're going to him.
Yes, yes. Now, of course, it was uncomfortable. Many people in the War Department, to use the old expression, always believe that I made end runs to accomplish some objective. I'm not saying that I wouldn't have if a principal had been involved. Actually, I never had to.
He believed in
it. He believed in it. You see, he saw so far ahead in a way that the testimony before the Congressional Committee will reflect that no one saw the need for manpower as it would develop in this war. He did.
I have a feeling that he hadn't spoken wholeheartedly and made it known very strongly that he couldn't have succeeded, could he?
It would have been at best a very limited, crippled organization.
I sort of skimmed through again, Patty's book, Coming Down. I've read it since I've worked in the office next to her. And she's
first a very fine girl.
And,
oh, no.
I knew a great many of the problems that she comes to my face on everything, uniforms.
It didn't make any difference, whether it was barracks, uniforms, training, utilization, they were all there. But nothing, nothing when you look back that you can consider unusual, because this really was a revolutionary attempt. And I must say that to have started as we started is totally unacceptable, and finished by having requisitions for 600,000 that we couldn't fill.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Of course, the Navy got along better because they weren't putting their people in the same sort of
situation. Well, they came later.
You'd already broken
it up. They had their problems, of course, and severe ones. The four women directors had sort of a joint personnel committee, which we met still had problems, but we had so many more.
Mm-hmm.
And we were putting them in such different jobs, and we were also sending them overseas, which of course no other service was doing.
In many ways, really, the tightest jobs to places.
That's right. Not the variety,
yes,
still.
Not the variety. But I'd really forgotten until I read through this again. Some item, one item of clothing would create great problems, and you get this one degree, and then requirements would degree. It would land back General Marshall, and that's so often, unless he personally told them, you do this, it would
sit on somebody's desk.
And they'd give it the runaround. Well, now, did General Somerville personally object to it, or was it just part of it?
No, I don't really believe General Somerville objected. He had many lieutenants that did.
Yes.
My own relationship with General Somerville, I don't mean to say that we were always in agreement.
No,
we always
no.
differed, but then there's nothing wrong with that. But it was an odd place. I really don't know whether this is emphatic. It was an odd place for it to have been finally assigned, because we were furnishing troops of ground, air, and service. And then, as you know, we became part of General Staff, and this made everything, of course, very much easier. And we were, first we reported to no one, really, so to speak. And then in the reorganization to services and supply, and then to the General Staff, well, everything was considerably used, because you know the rivalry among ground forces and services of supply was intense at that time. Once we were at the general staff level, many of these problems disappeared.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Of course, you were coming in at a time when the ground forces were having trouble getting supplies too, and everybody was fighting for the same.
Everybody was fighting. You know, a very different thing to experience it, and now look back on it in quite a detached way.
To live through, and I did see how you kept your strength. You did towards the end become almost ill.
Well, I was very ill when I left.
But you actually got into a sentence that you know was there in days of H.E.W.
Well, I have a penchant for drawing. I have a penchant for drawing the difficult ones. Anybody who could attempt to put the Federal Security Agency into a department and make it cohesive, you know, one of the most thrilling things I've ever done. Hard and disappointing. You couldn't move very fast. But my greatest challenge. In WAC, you had both organizational and general unacceptance of the idea.
Yes.
Now, in Federal Security Agency, in the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, you had some acceptance of the idea, but
that word, isn't
the polyglot of an organization you can possibly imagine.
They just picked up all the things and were left loose and
loose and put them over there.
I follow that coming down, going through some of your early problems there, and I thought, well, this would be wonderful training for that later job. Because they still have trouble getting a lot of these to work along together.
They will for a long time. Yes. They will for a long time. They get too many really unrelated things in that department.
Mm-hmm.
How can you administer federal credit unions? Is there anything more ridiculous in life? Administering federal credit unions, vocational rehabilitation,
mm-hmm.
public health, education, just...
It's fantastic.
It's fantastic.
But you had plenty of them the other way. In view of the fact that as I was leaving Washington, this Freedom March is beginning to start.
Well, I meant to ask if it's, has it gone quietly? I haven't even looked at the watch.
It was. I looked at the watch down.
Mm-hmm.
Going very quietly. But
what interested me was how in the early stages of the Elmhurst of Des Moines, you were able to work out this color question very easily.
It may look, easy in the books, Dr. Powell. Actually, it was not too difficult. It took a special kind of care and understanding. Mm-hmm. Most things can be solved with understanding,
yes,
as you well know. Really, I suppose this is not for.
Yes. Do you ever try to repeat a sentence?
It's particularly when they're good ones, they're often hard to remember.
I have never seen a man that could project himself more easily or more completely into the problems and situations of his subordinates, or for that matter, his superiors. This was a.
And then you said you thought that perhaps his intuitive faculties.
That his intuitive faculties some way contributed to this, because how could the chief of staff responsible for waging a war have knowledge of or be concerned with the kind of problems that he did. Not Wack, only many others. This had to be an intuitive faculty, and most great people have it, don't they?
But this, the color thing interests me, because I've run into several cases where he showed that he was thinking once more ahead of the army on this one. Although I think he agreed with the army, and it wasn't their place to solve
social problems.
But if for no other reason, then what is the best way to use this material? He's going to see to it that those who could accept responsibility were given. And it's amazing the time he spent on
working at. Well, you can say these were little problems, mm-hmm, but you and I both know that they could have become big problems,
yes,
very. I tell you a story, I don't know what made me think of it. General Marshall, in my years in the Army, overruled me once. And it's one of the dearest stories I can imagine. Before the invasion of Africa, I was in England a few days before the invasion of Africa. And in luncheon one day with General Eisenhower and Beadle Smith, they described a theoretical operation. And asked if they could have Wax. They wanted, as I recall, bilingual telephone operators. And so I said, when the situation is stabilized, I said, you remember now that these women are members of the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps. They are not members of the Army. Their benefits are the benefits of the civil servant, and I could not send them into an unstabilized situation with good conscience. When the situation is stabilized, you let me know. I'll send them. Well, you know the situation in Africa stabilized much sooner than anyone thought. So Beadle came over, and he reported in to General Marshall right away, and among the things, he told General Marshall that he was going down to see me to ask for some proofs. So he came, Beadle came on down to my office, and well, you stabilized much sooner than I thought. And I thought by the time you stabilized that I would have this bill passed, making these women members of the Army. I cannot agree to send them in submarine-infested waters in the battle condition as long as they are not members of the Army. He said, well, you know, of course, that I'm going to take this to the old man. And I said, of course, I don't blame you. But this is my position. He went on up to talk to John Marshall and said, wouldn't agree to do this. And Squawk Box went down and went to John Marshall's office. And he said, General Smith told me what you said about furnishing troops. I hope I can get this bill passed in Congress and send it as soon as I can. He looked at me and he said, what have you been doing ever since you've been here? As a civil servant, you've been in every battle condition in the world. And I said, well, that doesn't apply to me. Okay. I'm talking about troops for whom I'm responsible. And he looked at me and he said, Hitler won't wait. So as Frank McCarthy, who was then Secretary of the Stone, he buzzed Frank and he said, have you got two companies of women ready to go? And I said, yes, sir, in a training area in Daytona Beach. They're there training for these jobs. And he called Frank and he said, get my plane ready. Colonel Hobby is going to Daytona Beach. So Frank left. He said, are you unhappy? And I said, no, sir, I am not unhappy. I have an order, and I'll carry it out. He said, now, I know it troubled you to send these people there. He said, I want to tell you something. He said, you call the officers and enlisted women together, and you post encryption. You cannot tell them where they're going, but you can tell them that they're going into over submarine-infested waters and into hazardous conditions, and you ask for volunteers. And you tell them that the roster will be in the office in the morning. That no one will ever know, that you're not going to take them all. You have to pick, and no one will ever know who didn't volunteer. They may have reasons, family reasons, they may have reasons why. Well, I went on to Daytona that afternoon, called them together that night. This was before mess. And told them the roster would be ready for them to sign. And as I walked out of that room, people were pulling tablets and pencils out, signing their names and giving them to the CO. And before they left that room, every woman had volunteered. To me, I can think of many wartime. I did not make this story easy. Mm-hmm. But every woman volunteered.
That must have been something.
Yes, well, something you never forget.
Yes. But once more, he's understanding about it.
Yes. He knew how I felt. He knew he was absolutely right. This should have been done, but he also made it easy for me.
Yes. But that way you felt right about it.
That way I felt right about it.
Well, now, in connection with this thing over there, there did come up one other thing on which I know General Pike opposed it, and I suppose you felt it was unwise, which he said go ahead and do. That was the commissioning of the British WAC for Eisenhower and the ones in Australia.
Well, that Pope. I can almost remember what General Marshall said. He said he never felt like telling a man who was responsible for winning a war not to do little things that he thought would help him win the war.
Yeah. He was very strong that way.
Yeah. I have no quarrel with that.
Yeah.
To be sure, we hadn't done this before, but war creates many precedents. This caused something of a morale problem in WAC. It was a temporary one. It was a temporary thing. It didn't last long.
The thing I didn't hear of until after the war was over. Then I ran into parts of it in his correspondence because it was a very strong statement from General White against it, saying it's a dangerous thing to do. I saw this note that Frank wrote. Frank used to handle this thing and promised it while he was over there. And then apparently they were already moving in the same direction and General MacArthur said, well, on that score incident, the General Marshall several times talked about this fine officer he had, Colonel Newsom.
Colonel Newsom, a lovely lovely. This, you never knew. We wanted to pick someone that would be what he wanted and reflect great credit from the Corps. And great care was given to the selection of that officer. And
he said that she could just brief a group better than any officer he ever saw, and she could get everything just right. And then he said she'd bake cake too, because I went up to, I think it was Amherst, and she'd marry him.
Mm-hmm.
And she made him a cake and sent it to him. He said, "It's a good cake."
Yes, he was about very fine. Of course, there were so many.
There's a story in Patty's book about somebody that General Smith picked the most bedraggled looking girl to come off the boat. They were all, they hadn't had chance, time to change anything. He picked her for his office. And I should know who that was. I used to know everybody in his office, but I don't know. Of course, Ruth Briggs, I suppose, had been there before that time.
Wasn't Ruth one of the first five to go over?
I expect she was, because she lived a long time.
Yeah, I think she was one of the first five. I can see this girl you're talking about, but I can't.
But I don't think that's Ruth. I think this
I can't. I can't tell you her name.
But you see, when the war ended, the Beatles said, "Now, after Jim Latimer left, he went to S.L.A. Marshall, the historian, and said, the general wants somebody to put together the history of shave." So I was sent up to do it, and I sat in the suite of office where Beadle was. So I got to know everybody on his staff. But I can't think who this might have been. Or maybe the girl was gone by that time. We were at Frankfurt
there.
Mm-hmm. But then, of course, Smith came back before long, and then soon was in Moscow before I got back from right.
This was a character, wasn't it?
You know Miss Smith died 3 days ago?
I saw it. Didn't know she'd been ill.
Cancer. She'd been there about six, 7 weeks ago. I was called by Miss Marshall to find out about...
How is Miss Marshall?
She's pretty well. I'd heard from her the day before yesterday. She's going to Frankfurt in October to attend the dedication of a monument to General Marshall.
Oh, dear.
And she said she wouldn't make the trip or anything else, but there's...
Is she able to make the trip?
I believe so.
The last note I had from her, her handwriting was so...
It's very irregular. She's coming down to Walter Reed the 3rd or 4th of September for checkup, see if it's all right. And then, unless something changes, I think really what why she wants to go. She wants to go to Alan's grave in Anzio. And this is a means to do it. But she called me to find out what had gone, what had happened to a letter she'd sent to the Secretary of State asking if there was any objection to her going. She felt that she shouldn't go if there was any possible reason, and she hadn't got an answer. But it was one of those things that had gone, but had gone the wrong place. So I called, and someone in the process told me that Mrs. Smith was dying. I told her this, and she said, "Well, I was afraid that was it, because I hadn't heard from her for a while."
Beatrice Smith, in connection with General Marshall, reminds me of a story which would be no use to you, but which I would never forget. One afternoon, I guess about 3, Frank McCarthy called down and said that I could be in my office the rest of the afternoon. General Marshall wanted to see me, and I said, "Yes, I was." He said we was going to the White House. He would call me when he got back. Well, this was the old War Department building long before we were in the Pentagon. And dark came, you know how they turned the lights out in the building then. I was still sitting in my office. And the telephone rang, and it was Beadle. And he said, "General Marshall said that he remembered he'd asked you to wait, and he'd been delayed quite a while. Would I come down to your office and bring you up to his office?" So down Beadle came, the dark artist, and get up. It was the night, I can identify the night for you. It was the night of the rumor of a ship, unidentified ship, Chesapeake Bay, that was going to bomb Washington.
I remember that.
Yeah. Well, Beadle was sitting there, you know, taking these calls back and forth, and he was in liaison to the White House, if you remember. And I said, by the way, I'll tell you something. He said, I said, Malvina Thompson called me today to tell me he'd been an army officer over interviewing Mrs. Roosevelt and asking her how she thought the War Department could utilize wax. Malvina called me to tell me. He thought that she said, don't you know how to do it? Don't you know what you're going to do with them? And she's going to also be here interviewing Mrs. Roosevelt. I asked her, was she? So I said, well, Malvina, do you remember his name, where he came from? This was nobody from my office. And she said, well, I'll find out for you. She called back and she gave the officer's name. It was somebody from Adjutant General's office. So I said to Eli, I wish you could keep these people from going over there. This had not been an easy thing anyway, I think you must have known. And I said, I'm getting more free advice now than I know what to do with. And he said, I told him the story. Oh, he said, some nitwit. And I said, well, some nitwit, all right, but this was a man in the ADO. Oh, he said, one of our nitwits.
He could be very severe. But on Ms. Roosevelt, I noticed that she turned up for one or two of the ceremonies with the president. Was it Des Moines they came to?
They both went. Let me see. The president went to... No, I'm not sure whether the president went to Des Moines or Chattanooga. He went to one.
I know
she went. Yeah. I know she went to Des Moines. It's awful to remember, but I think he came to Chattanooga.
There's a picture in that book showing him sitting there. The girls marched by or something.
I think that's the photo.
And, well, now...
You always had a great interest in it, by the way.
He did?
Yes, yeah, sort of whimsical interest, to be sure, because he was a man of whimsy. And, of course, Ms. Roosevelt always had.
But did she tend to interfere in any way?
No, I honestly... Everybody believed that she would. Honestly, she didn't.
They got a little tired over in the War Department about passing on things about mistreatment, or alleged mistreatment of Negroes.
Yes,
and,
I got
But I never found that on General Marshall's part there was any resentment of it, that there was on the part of the
world. I know there was. But I'm not attempting to say for a minute that she didn't pass on letters of criticism. But what else could she have done? I consider that appropriate.
I didn't see in hundreds of cases that are in the files, I didn't see where she said, do this, or do something about it. She just said, this is for your information. This is the way it is.
She never did, to me.
All that happened was, of course, if she said it, then they certainly looked into it.
But you see, this is something I think I always understood, and maybe many Army officers didn't. What else could she do with it? She was the wife of the President of the United States. And in my opinion, there was nothing else that she could have done.
I didn't see her. She couldn't very well just run in and say, Franklin, here's something's come in.
On that same point, that you know, for a while, Jonathan Daniels, so Jonathan, for once in a while, called me up and give me something. Well, after he left the White House, and he called me on something, and when he finished talking, he said, Obie, I will tell you something. You're the only person in Washington that treats me with the same courtesy now that you treated me when you were working. And I said, well, why shouldn't I? You're the same person. You're my friend. We've been friends for years. Well, but he said, you'd be surprised.
Yeah.
And I said, well, John, when you called me from the White House, you never did tell me to do anything. And I said, I never had a call from you that I didn't appreciate and didn't know that you had to do. So I think this is sort of a lack of understanding. There was nothing else she could have done. This was not true in the Army. You know, it was true the government over. They'd say, well, Ms. Roosevelt said this. So.
Well, there was a special thing they put on with it. I helped do the history of Second Army in 1943. And I know the letters that came to Ben Lear were sent down. These had to be looked into within 24 hours. Of course, there always had to be a letter go out to members of Congress and to people like Ms. Roosevelt at once saying that it had been received and was being acted.
never forget this thing was across the top of the letter. I don't remember whether it was red or what it was, but it was. And otherwise, it might very well have been suspended. But what amazed me was General Marshall. A private could write him about something, and he would see that action was taken on it because they laid on his desk, I don't know whether it was once a week or once a day, a line or two out of each letter that came in. Sometimes it was, these extracts would fill 20 or 30 pages. The man's name, the background and all that. And he'd just run down the list and say, send me this letter and I want to see it in full. And then of course he'd say, look at the letter and see something done about it. And I think this was one of his causes, his bigness too, that he would take time about it. Now, he understood, of course, that this is the essence of morale, but
he told me what you're talking about, morale. And this was, you know, over the, before Pearl Harbor, of course. And it must have been about the time that the passage of the Selective Service extending the draft, if you remember, if you remember it passed by one vote. And he asked me to go somewhere. I could not tell you what this was. And this was one was over the hills.
He leaves to talk about Ohio.
And I said, General Marshall, I wouldn't know whether the morale was good or bad with that camp. He looked up and he said, you will get to the point where you can walk on a post, camp, or station and sniff and know whether morale is good or bad. Of course, this was true. I later learned during the war this was true.
I know I've had a few people who were out of sorts in General Marshall one way or another who would complain that he'd only come and stay a half day at their place.
Oh, no.
And then he'd say he'd go away and think he'd see something, but
he saw what he'd see.
In the first place, he didn't go usually to their messes or into the top people, and he always insisted they bring him some good non-com to talk to. And apparently they would talk to him openly, but he knew exactly what he wanted to see. He said, I usually ate in the plane because I didn't want to take up their time, and I wasn't going to learn anything there. And he said, I always tried to find something before I left that I could take a note on and take care of it the minute I got back. So it's
I don't know, is it in Patty's book about the clothing situation at Des Moines?
You mean lack of clothing? Yeah. There's something about it that they were drilling without. I know there's something about the fight over the two overcoats.
Well, I'm trying to recall it. When I was coming from Denver, I guess, into Des Moines, and I was talking to about the woman assistant CO, goodness, years ago. And she said, Colonel Hobby, it is very cold at the moment. No. I landed in Des Moines with a winter uniform. And it was cold as could be. And here were the blacks. Summer uniform and no overcoat. And here all the male officers in winter uniforms and overcoats. I walked up to my quarters, took my winter uniform off and put on my summer uniform and went on out. And I went over to speak to the quartermaster to ask him what happened to the clothes. Well, some big thing, you know. Well, you know what happened. There was not yardage in the officer. So I called a quartermaster and asked him what happened to these women's overcoats that I could understand. Maybe they hadn't enough winter uniforms, but it was cold, and these women had coats. Well, they didn't have any. I forgot to get Patty's book and see after 2 years. But I said, I didn't care what kind of coats they sent. I'm just sending soldiers' coats. And I wanted them out there. Well, this blew the War Department wide open. This was cold. This was really cold. And here were the male officers in winter clothes. Gave me all trouble on the overcoat. I could remember some of the names. But those are silly little things, but it was the kind of thing that when you got into even that kind of problem, General Marshall always saw that it happened. He didn't care if they were drilling with overcoats down past their ankles, and they were men's overcoats, but they were warm.
Well, did they actually wear those for a while?
Oh, yes, they did.
I know she does say group came up there from the south in summer clothes, but nothing else, and they had to put them to bed for a day or something.
Well, that may well be true.
And that, but apparently after you went out, there was a telegram saying send so many thousand of this, and at once, and I remember the overshoots were involved in that.
Yeah. Overshoots, no.
Of course, they didn't have sizes of those either.
Well, those early days were...
Well, now, did he favor from the beginning making this part of the army? Or did you help...
I don't believe... I'd have to reread the testimony, Dr. Bell. I am not certain whether the question ever arose. But yes, he did favor. He did favor.
Wouldn't have worked any other way, would it?
No. But you see, when the Corps was formed, I think I remember saying, the House Military Affairs Committee, that the maximum strength would probably be 10,000 women. Well, it would have been possible, I suppose, to have administered 10,000 women as an auxiliary corps. But when you got into the numbers, and you were dispersing them the way you were dispersing, there was no other way to treat it. And in fairness, this was the way it should have been from the beginning.
Well, Patrick's very clear on that you would soon be faced with, or were faced actually, with the problem you had in the First War about their rights to all sorts of payments and hospitalization. Benefits in case of death.
Yeah.
I know until General Marshall was ill, the last time he continued to get letters from a woman who had been a field clerk in the First World War. And she was still trying to get some sort of service connection. One, but the thing that really worried her was that she wanted some sort of a ribbon indicating that she
served.
And he felt very much touched by it because apparently she'd been a very capable secretary, but he couldn't do anything more about it. And it finally got to be an obsession, obviously.
Well, I still get letters. Of course, my WAC letters are people at veterans. It turned out, for one reason or another, and all the disappointed ones I hear from regularly.
You still have a considerable file.
Oh, yes.
Principal is Langdon, Marshall and General Bradley.
In a few minutes.
You probably have something.
Well, that's I have in a few minutes. That's all right. See you there.
All right. Will you let me know then when you're...
We go right here.
All right. Well, before I forget this, after you left the WAC, did you have any particular contacts with General Gearing in the period of the Marshall? And did you work on the committee in that period, or
no?
On the Red Cross.
Well, that reminds me of a very amusing story. I went on the board of Red Cross after, and we were in Detroit for a meeting, and I had always leave word with my switchboard where I'm going to be wherever I am. So I called in the office to tell them that I was going to a night to up to General Miss Marshall's apartment for dinner, and we were going to a baseball game. Sitting there having dinner, and about the beginning of the Korean War. And there's a call came through from the War Department, G1, ordering me to return to active duty. And I was not a reservist. So I said I was not a reservist. Well, gentlemen, as Marshal sitting here, they couldn't. They overheard everything I said, and I said, I'm not a reservist, and I can't order me back to active duty. General Marshall said, ask them. They want you to return to active duty or stay on the mission, and I've just set you, just put you on setting up blood banks. So I said to, I've forgotten whatever officer, I said, General Marshall says to ask you whether you want to try to order me back to active duty or leave me on the job. He just put me on setting up blood banks.
Sort of took care of that. Well, I'm sure he must have. Must have worked with him in the Red Cross, and I didn't know whether or not he can come here during that fight on the Marshall Plan today. He spoke at Pittsburgh and Los Angeles, but he used the women's organizations tremendously.
Tremendous.
He said they...
I had given him the framework, you see, in the Defense Advisory Committee.
I see.
And he had it.
Oh, I see.
He came here once and stayed with us, but he came to speak to the VMI group.
But I remember that he said, these darn men's organizations wouldn't get moving. And so I just went and worked for the women. But all they really...
Can you turn that thing off and let me tell you a
story? Just a final summation of what you felt General Marshall did and stood for.
Well, he was a soldier in the finest sense of the word, because to him, being a soldier meant putting your country first, always. But of course, he was a great soldier, and he was also a great human being with extraordinary. I hate to use the word vision, because really it was more than that. He had an extraordinary feel for the future. Not only as a military man, but as a citizen of the United States. And I know a few men that commanded greater loyalty than he commanded.